You can learn a lot about the economic, political, and social conditions that shaped Appalachia by picking up a copy of Thomas Kiffmeyer's book, Reformers to Radicals. It's a University Press of Kentucky publication that tells the story of the Appalachian Volunteers and the War on Poverty. Dr. Kiffmeyer teaches history at Morehead State University, and he's here to talk about the book. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
So let's begin with this. Who were the Appalachian Volunteers?
Well, initially, the Appalachian Volunteers, it was an idea that came out of the Council of the Southern Mountains at Berea College. And it's actually on the forefront of Johnson's War on Poverty. So they're formed actually before, during the Kennedy administration, in reality.
An answer to President Kennedy's call.
Kennedy says, ask not what your country can do for you, what you can do for your country. And that seemed to stimulate, not just amongst young people, because they were young people, but an older generation as well. Most of that older generation were New Deal liberals, FDR Democrats. And Kennedy's call stimulates a number of people to be more active participants in U.S. society. So they start out as college students. The idea was to get college students from Appalachia. The Council of Southern Mountains recruited from, of course, Berea, University of Kentucky, Morehead, Eastern, Union, every institution in Eastern Kentucky. The idea was have Appalachians helping Appalachians. That way they'll be more accepted in these local communities.
Instead of coming down out of the Northeast.
Instead of coming from Chicago or New York or San Francisco or, Cleveland, Cincinnati even.
And so how would you describe the prevailing social and economic conditions of the times when these volunteers formed and began their mission in Appalachia?
Well, in the region itself, the situation was pretty dire. In 1950, United Mine Workers signed a new contract with the coal operators that embraced mechanization. The idea behind the president, John Lewis, of the mine workers was that this would end up in better jobs, but less jobs. So you had a significant unemployment starting mid-50s into the 60s. So the situation was dire. What's most intriguing on a certain level is that when the volunteers first started working in Eastern Kentucky, in the more rural, remote places, they focused on one-room schools, the volunteers, the activists would come in and they said, the only people that are here, it's the grandparents and the grandkids. Everybody at that prime working age was migrating to Cincinnati or Cleveland or Baltimore.
Detroit,
right. It's sort of still going on from the World War II migration. So you have a serious unemployment. You have actually a dearth of working age, prime working age people. And they're trying to maintain these families, in the face of all this economic hardship. And the attitude, of course, we still see this attitude. It's what J.D. Vance is talking about in Hillbilly Elegy. It's been in existence since the Colored Riders of the late 19th century of sort of this dysfunctional place, right? Isolated, which is kind of interesting to call it isolated when you're dealing with, this is where America's energy is coming from. How can it be isolated, right? So it's the consequences of economic development, not the lack of economic development that's really driving the situation in Eastern Kentucky, West Virginia.
And so were most of the Appalachian volunteers drawn from Eastern Kentucky institutions and universities, or did we have them coming from off, as we like to say, in this neck of the woods, from the Northeast and from the North?
Okay, so there's an interesting transformation that happens. Initially, the council, they go to the registrar's office and they ask, can we get names and addresses, or can you point us to Appalachian natives, if you will, right? Mm-hmm. People from Knott County or Letcher County or what have you, right? And all those institutions in Eastern Kentucky. And in the first iteration, the Appalachian volunteers, this is how I like to deal with it as I go through, they're Appalachians. So they're from Eastern Kentucky, most of them, or the vast, vast majority of them. And they actually volunteer. So they're not getting paid anything. They're recruiting, again, from UK and from Morehead and from Eastern. They're kids who were born and raised, and one of the ironies here is, part of the picture that Americans, including people in the County of Southern Mountains, is that the more rural Appalachians don't value education, so they go looking for rural Appalachians at the University of Kentucky. How do you do that?
Yeah.
So there's these disconnects that are going to happen through the whole story, and that's just sort of foreshadowing some of the bigger disconnects that are coming later, Right? So there are Appalachians and they are volunteers. Now, as this continues, and so we'll let the story unfold as it goes, as they continue, you're going to see different meanings to what Appalachian means and what volunteer means as we go from 64 to 68.
How were these volunteers received in the communities that they arrived in and began working in?
Initially, they're coming in, and they're coming in with a pretty benign prescription for the problem, right? So it's this quintessential, it'll drive you nuts if you do this long enough, because it's that same kind of, oh, they're dysfunctional, their value system's outdated, you know, the same kind of thing we're hearing today in 2019 now, right? So they're coming with this attitude, and you have to think about Appalachia as not being, you know, monolithic. Right. So they're coming in to fix schoolhouses. Right. So, yeah, I'm going to, you know, kind of, you know, be figurative here. The first thing they do is go to Lowe's, you know, or the whatever the 1960 version of Lowe's is, and because they want building materials to repair the school. If they repair the school, it'll be more attractive. That'll draw kids to school. They're staying in school. And there's that, you know, education is the key to economic success and the key to social and political success. Right. So at that level, you know, you got to look close because it's subtle. If you're in the county seat, right, if you're the school superintendent or you're the county county judge executive, this is great. You're repairing the buildings. You're repairing the infrastructure. They don't have to. You're doing it for them. It's basically free. It's donated material. It's donated labor. This is awesome. I think you can see, and there's a story I talk about in Mill Creek in Clay County, Kentucky, where they come in and it's sort of, I get this feeling of, okay, they're back again and they're going to do this again. I want to say there's
with a roll of the eye.
Yeah. Like, oh, yeah. Here we go. Okay. Let's humor, you know, the outsiders who've been coming in here. Again, you'll see this in, you know, in the New Deal with the Rural Electrification Administration, the Rural Resettlement Administration. You know, this attempt to modernize Appalachia is almost a century old by the time the War on Poverty starts. So you get this, oh, yes, here they come again. And we have to be nice because, you know, you're not rude, right? So it's a really, really, really complex, varied by degree, you know, how the AVs are received in the county seats, depending on who they are. Oh, this is great. They're doing good work and they're helping us. And I don't have to do it now. So I got free labor and free material. I think in some of these places, it's like, oh, here we go again kind of idea. Some might be trying to manipulate it for their own self-interest out in those little communities. So it's really a complex story of how they're received. It's no one person receives them probably the same way as the next.
Am I understanding this correctly, that at some point along the way, the students realize that the root causes of the poverty that they had come to try to rectify could be found in the nation's political economy and not necessarily in the regional culture? Did that lead to a kind of parting of the ways between the volunteers and their political and their government backers?
Government backers on every level, of course. Johnson himself, you know, he's a New Dealer. In the New Deal, of course, the government said, this is how we're going to do things. And they created the CCC and the WPA. And, you know, it's very top down, right? And that's Johnson's vision of how social programs work. For some of the New Dealers, the older guys in Berea College, they're New Dealers too. So they're going to see it the same way. But when you get into these more specific places and more specific circumstances, this takes on a whole new dynamic, right? And it happens. So this transformation happens relatively quickly. The AVs start out the early years in 63, 64, into 65. They're going in for summer projects and weekend projects. You know, it's kind of piecemeal and it's fragmented throughout the year. By the time we get into 66, 67, this is when that what is an Appalachian and what is a volunteer, those two words start to shift. As you go for year-long projects, you got to have more people. Part of the War on Poverty was VISTA, the Volunteers in Service to America, which is still kind of around, though in a different guise. It needs more people. And you get training funds. Organizations get training funds. So more money's coming in. If you train people, you get more money from the federal government. So the desire to bring people in becomes really, really important. So now Appalachia becomes a geographic place. not an identity of who you are, right? And of course, you're a college student, and you get a stipend for being a VISTA. So it, you know, it becomes a way to save for college. So the motivations start to change. It's not so much helping other people as it is, this is kind of a cool job. By the time you get later in the 60s, it's alternative service for Vietnam. Some will be angry with me for saying this, but it becomes a little more self-serving. And you're not so much volunteering, you're doing it for the summer stipend because that helps you pay for college and keeps you out of the draft, you know, when we get, you know, later in the 60s in Vietnam. So it starts to change, and that's part of it. The other part is when, as they leave after those summers or leave after those Christmas break projects, and then they go, they think, we fixed the school. It's going to be attractive, right? And they expect these changes and these superficial fixes to continue. And then they go back and realize they're not really changing much. There's a great quote that I found. One of the AVs says, and I applaud them for this, you know, even though I'm critical of them, I applaud them for this. Is they say, we're lighting candles when they need electricity. You know, we're hitting these superficial things. They're lasting maybe a couple months, and then the whole thing's falling apart again. You know, their value system isn't the problem here. There's something bigger going on. Unemployment is still high. Access to basic goods and services still isn't happening. You know, the concentration of wealth is still in the county seats and not filtering out to these people out there. And it does. It happens very, very quickly. And part of the reason that happens, I think, on one hand, the good part, I think they're right in their assessment. And part of that is because they're bringing in these different viewpoints that are coming in through VISTA and those type of programs. They start coming in from Chicago and Cleveland and Pittsburgh and, you know, wherever. Sort of a different migration. Appalachians going out. Now we got people out there coming in.
Right? Might that explain why over, again, a short time, things really changed? It went from honoring a president's call to service to ending up being accused of sedition, of being un-American. How in the world did all that happen so quickly?
That's what makes the 60s so fascinating. I always have when I get to the 60s in my classes at Moorhead, I'll put on the Beatles in 1964 and they're singing Love Me Do. Mm-hmm. And then I say, okay, now look at that. Well, look, and here's 8 years later, you know, I'm playing, you know, the White Album and Revolution. Right? Look at the differences. This is dramatic, and it happens very, 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 very quickly. And these changes come from all the outside forces that are going on, the Vietnam War, the civil rights movement, right? And as these outsiders, if you will, are coming in, of course, now they're more exposed to these ideas, and they're bringing them into Appalachia.
In the brief amount of time that we have, I wanted to ask you something that we touched on earlier, and I said that I was going to come around to. The characterization of mountain culture offered at the turn of the 20th century by Berea College founder William Goodell Frost seemed to describe a people who were in, but not of, America. And to this day, in recent months, we hear from people in the region who say they feel as though they're viewed by outsiders as somehow foreign or as immigrants in their own country. Most notably, I've heard this from the writer Silas House. Have you encountered this view?
Yes, and I think it's getting more and more prevalent. And I think, as I've written more recently, I think the war on poverty, I think, is now the pivotal event of the late 20th century. Not just Johnson's side of it, but like Martin Luther King's side of it. The civil rights side of it, the AV side of that. Is this where this is turning now, right? A lot of Americans in those more urban sectors, even today, and I think you see this in the phenomena of Donald Trump, right? When Donald Trump says, make America great again, why does that appeal to so many people in, you know, West Virginia, right? At the same token, it was Bernie Sanders that was the appeal on the other side. Mm-hmm. And you look in the primaries, right? Mm-hmm. These two, you know, what we might call outside ideas in the usual political spectrum, right? Those are the ones that are attracting people in West Virginia, Eastern Kentucky. The way most Americans interpreted the war on poverty, urban Americans, where increasingly we're living and concentrating ourselves, right? They you know, middle class, my parents, for example, even saw the war on poverty as something that was done to them, but for somebody else. Right? You know, I this image I have, I was a little kid when the war on poverty was going on, but as I've grown to understand not just it, but my parents' generation, is my father was struggling to make that middle-class lifestyle.
And where did you grow up?
I grew up in the west side of Cincinnati. So I think that's how, from a Cincinnati kid, I ended up, you know, in Moorhead doing Eastern Kentucky and the War on Poverty.
You know, I feel that this book is going to turn out to be one of those that gets referred to when you're trying to educate people about this region.
I hope
so. There are very few of those, and Dr. Kiffmeyer, I think you've written one of them. We're just about out of time, but I want to ask you, how would you say this past that you've written about, how does that inform where we are now?
Well, as I said, I think the War on Poverty has become the pivotal event upon how we start thinking about and defining who or what we are going to be as a society. Before the War on Poverty, it was World War II. And when we thought about ourselves, make America great again, as Donald Trump likes to say, you coming out of World War II, when were we great? You know, look at the GI Bill, right? That made America great. The problem is the benefits were sort of limited, right, for a lot of reasons, most of them are racist reasons, right? So the War on Poverty has become the pivotal event because it's growing from the New Deal. These are the handout programs, the entitlements that the right likes to condemn, and many on the left say don't go far enough. So we have to think about how this War on Poverty was, what it meant. What did it mean to those people, you know, those county judge executives and whatnot? You know, what did it mean to them? What did it mean for activists, people who are looking to say, if we are great and democracy is great, what does it mean for those activists who I do think believe thought they were bringing that greatness to places that didn't have it? What does it mean to the subjects of the targets of our reform efforts? Are we imposing these reforms? Are they welcoming these reforms? You know, it's African Americans that are the other outsiders. And if you look at the history of the civil rights movement, you have the struggle of one group of outsiders trying to get in because they've been said, you know, we're especially in the Deep South, we're pushing you out. And then you turn to Appalachia, another disaffected group. And if you look about how I see them reacting to the War on Poverty, they're kind of saying, no, again, here we go again. You're going to try to tell us how to live. Maybe they want to be out, you know, not in an alien sense. I want to live in a cabin in the woods. I think that would be great, you know. What are their attitudes towards this? So you see one group trying to say, blacks, the civil rights movement is most of them, we want to be part of America. And I think on a certain level, certain Appalachians, we want to be part of America too, but we want it on our own terms, right? So how are we going to do this? How are we going to make America great again when greatness means different things to so many different people?
Question for the times. Dr. Thomas Kiffmeyer teaches history at Moorhead State University. He's the author of Reformers to Radicals, The Appalachian Volunteers and the War on Poverty, published by the University Press of Kentucky. And thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. I had a great time.